So energy, virya, it's again the energy is a poor translation. Its more accurate translation is heroism. It's interesting, that's a more accurate translation. Because it also has different domains. It's also used interchangeably with energy and effort, both dimensions. It's energy, it's effort. Heroism. It's kind of like the sort of warrior spirit, the determination spirit, the resolve spirit, with the cultivation spirit within all of this path. I mean, I think we all appreciate how much energy and effort it takes to travel this path. You know, just to show up for the moment. Just to be awake sometimes. Just to be willing to actually translate the teaching into our lives. And it's a really moment-to-moment energy. So, it's not uncommon for people to report they don't feel that they have the energy that it takes. Let's look at whether that's a myth or not. How much of our energy is dissipated in proliferation, in obsession, and in distractedness that leaves us feeling exhausted? You ever consider that? I mean, I see this on retreat, you know, I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? You know, all we do is sit around. You know, occasionally we get up and go for a little toddle, and then come back and sit around some more. And when the kind of the reports of how exhausted people are, it's like we've been running marathons. What have you done today? Oh, I sat around. Where has the energy gone? Notice when there's craving or aversion, how much energy arises with it. Notice when you're really enraged, you probably never felt more awake in your entire life. Notice when we really, really want something, it feels like there's inexhaustible reserves of energy to go after this. Notice when we really want to get rid of something, how much energy there seems to be available for us to try and manipulate our world and manipulate conditions. Energy and effort are part of every undertaking in our life. They're particularly things that we love, whether it's raising a child, walking, communicating, but equally energy is involved in undertaking a vendetta. I think the real question is how we use the energy we have, whether wisely or unwisely, whether in pursuit of the skillful or the unskillful. It's also curious how meditative training increases energy levels. That's very interesting. From, you know, you certainly see this in kind of more formal settings of retreats, you know, particularly longer retreats, from the first days feeling of levels of exhaustion, it really is as if we've never worked more hard in our life, to actually, you know, needing much less sleep, being much more awake. The calming of agitation releases energy. I think there's really no question about this. Certainly, of course, there's energy levels that change as we age or are ill and all of these things. But in terms of kind of energy, meditative energy, really is much more available in the calming of agitation. So why is virya translated as heroism? I think it is because of the energy and effort in the path that is so dedicated to releasing the unskillful, the greed and hatred and delusion, and developing the skillful. It is asking us to step beyond the boundaries of what we know. I think that's why it's called heroism. Because it's stepping beyond the boundaries of what we know into what we don't know. It's a stepping out of the familiarity of our habits and identities that even when they're painful or unsatisfying, they are known. It is heroic, I think, to stretch our boundaries, to step out of our comfort zones, to explore what it is to rely and depend and lean upon nothing. I think it's heroic to be willing to embrace the fear that can arise when we do see our certainties and our worlds begin to crumble, and to realize that our worlds have always been crumbling. To realize that our worlds have always been crumbling. That safety or certainty, perhaps, has always been an illusion. It's heroic to swim against cultural tides, and it's certainly heroic to swim against the tides of our own reactivity. It's actually fairly heroic to seek for stillness rather than agitation, to forsake craving and becoming. We see it's actually often fairly heroic to be still, for example, rather than to engage in gossip, to be popular, to be liked and approved of. Sometimes it's pretty heroic to say no to the causes of injustice and suffering. It's pretty heroic to challenge ill will and hatred. I think in our own worlds it's pretty heroic to cultivate compassion rather than disconnection. And it's fairly heroic to open to the depths of sorrow and pain in our world rather than to lose ourselves in distraction. It's heroic to stay steady on the path in moments when there doesn't feel to be any real evidence of progress or change, and to be able to stay just steady. In one of the Tibetan texts it says, the essence of energy, or the essence of virya, is the finding of joy in the undertaking of the wholesome and skillful actions, thoughts, and words. That this is the essence of virya. Energy does not come from shoulding. Energy does not come from striving, from forcing, from I should do this, you know, it's the right thing to do. Energy comes when we actually find joy or feel the joy of undertaking the wholesome and the skillful. Energy is not only virya, and I'd rather use the word virya in a way that, you know, there's, sometimes there's no replacements, is there? Virya, this heroism, energy, effort, it's not only one of the paramis, it's one of the factors of awakening and one of the spiritual powers. It's identified with effort in the Eightfold Path, and in reality, energy is the mental factor of wise effort. It's the psychological factor of wise effort. It's directly linked to concentration, the capacity to gather and collect our attentiveness, and virya is what supports mindfulness. Without virya, mindfulness has no foundation, no support. It's a big one. It's a really big one. Now, the parami of energy, like all the paramis, it doesn't stand alone. But all the paramis nurture and support each other. So in many ways, energy or virya is looking back to insight. You know, it's looking backwards to insight. Because this is where it's finding joy, it's where it's finding reason, it's where it's finding direction, a sense of aspiration and motivation. And energy is looking forward to patience. Looks forward to patience. Does anybody have any? Yeah.
Do you mean anticipates by looking forward?
No, it's supporting patience. It's actually fueled by insight, and it's actually tempered by patience, I might almost say. Tempered by patience. Because energy without being tempered by patience, you know, like all the paramis, has that shadow side, and it becomes striving and forcing and demanding and insistence without the parami of patience to temper it. I think the concept of motivation probably, it fits most directly, well, it fits in so many places, but I think mostly it fits into the whole quality of insight, which is there in generosity, it's there in sila, you know, it's there in the Four Noble Truths. I mean, that motivation, you know, there's different levels of motivation. There's a kind of motivation we feel in a crisis, you know. I got to go on retreat. You know, my world is falling apart. You know, it's flash-like motivation. It doesn't sustain. There's a kind of motivation that arises when we have a particularly pleasant meditative experience. Get me back into that hall. You know, I can hardly wait. It doesn't sustain. And then there's a kind of motivation which is much more deeply rooted, I think, in insight, which actually withstands the highs and the lows, the peaks and the valleys, which is actually born much more on this whole level of reflection upon the teaching and knowing it as a truth inwardly, that we have to be able to envision an end of suffering as a genuine possibility in our own lives, in our own path, in our own hearts. So that takes a certain level of investigation of the teaching. You know, I mean, I, in the kind of training that I had, you know, we weren't really given any meditation instruction for months, actually. Instead, the whole first, I would say the whole first 6 months of my training, maybe 9 months, was dedicated to developing right motivation through these various reflections, just reflections upon suffering and its cause, reflections upon compassion, reflections upon interconnectedness, reflections upon death, reflections upon karma. And it was almost as if one had to sort of, we were encouraged to sort of ripen this sense of this wider motivation, not just about me or my story or my experiences, this wider story of motivation, and then began to practice in the light of that. Now, this was a little bit more difficult in Western culture. You know, most people, you know, you come on, people come on retreat, you know. We're not going to spend 6 months or a year saying, you know, just come on retreat for 3 years and contemplate motivation. But it's not a bad thing, because many people come on retreats and they actually really have a taste. They just have a taste of what a mind of calmness looks like, about what a mind of kindness looks like, about what it looks like to be really present and awake. And that inspires the motivation sufficiently. But motivation, you know, it's really about sustaining motivation rather than just flash-like, spark-like motivation that's governed by pleasant and unpleasant experience. You know, I mean, I talk about it, you know, I used to be a sort of crisis gym user, you know. I would only ever go to the gym when everything completely went pear-shaped, you know. And then I'd go to the gym and look at all these young things in Lycra beside me, looking, how come it's so easy for them? Why, you know why it's so easy for them? Because they do it all the time. You know, and now these days, since I've become a more dedicated gym user, I know why it's easier. You know, it's because you sustain the motivation.
Those first 6 months, was that in Theravada?
Mahayana. But that's a very traditional Galoop training. But it is really seen that motivation does not also stand independent of the other paramis. It certainly doesn't stand independent of investigation. There's some way of internal, you know, going, stepping out of the distractedness of our lives and actually what matters here. What really matters here.
I just wanted to add a thought to that with motivation. Isn't it seems to me that it has a lot to do also with the spirit with which we do it, like not looking for so. An outcome of this specific kind? Or?
Yeah. As I mentioned, and it's very, you know, certainly in the Tibetan tradition, it's the joy in undertaking the wholesome and skillful. And there's something very immediate about that, you know. And sometimes I think we skip over that a little bit. You know, I think particularly in Western culture, because we're more inclined to see the imperfect, you know, the problem, we tend at times to a little bit skip over the simple joy of undertaking the wholesome and the skillful, which is actually part of all our lives in the smallest ways. You know, when I open the door for the person in front of me, or the person in front of me opens the door for me. You know, when I feel able to just offer a simple moment of generosity, when I speak kindly rather than harshly, the joy of undertaking the wholesome and the skillful is really something to have a moment of pause with. Because that is actually the most motivating at all. Because actually we see in that moment outcome. You know, it's not about some distant future outcome. It's about the immediacy of that outcome. What is it that gladdens the heart? You know, what is it that truly gladdens the heart? And it's always the wholesome and the skillful. You know, what is it that contracts the heart? It is always the unskillful. You know? But to see the immediacy of that is appreciating the joy of undertaking those. That's very motivating. And that the more, you know, I think the more developed sense of that motivation is virya. It is this unshakable commitment, heroism, energy, effort, you know, that is not dissuaded. That is not dissuaded. But that is it's a developing, you know, it's a development. It's not a given. In speaking about the paramis, the perfections, I do feel it's important to continually remember that what we are talking about here is not something particularly theoretical or abstract. That we are really talking about our path, the path we are walking on, this very timeless path that so many people have walked on for 2,600 years, meeting exactly the same challenges that we meet, encountering many of the same joys, but certainly practicing with the same minds and hearts that we practice with today. And it's really in the midst of all of that that we develop and cultivate and endeavor to embody the paramis or the ten perfections. These are really not something separate from our lives. They're not something separate from our practice. Indeed, just, you know, reiterating that they really are the fabric of awakening, the fabric of compassion, and the very deepening in our own practice, the very deepening in our own path, is directly linked to our capacity to develop these paramis and bring them to fruition. You know, because this is really speaking, the paramis are really speaking about how we change, transform the shape of our minds, the shape of our hearts, the shape of our lives. Qualities that we cultivate certainly on the cushion or in informal meditation, but just as much qualities that we are asked to cultivate in the whole of our lives, the entirety of our lives. So before we continue this morning, I did just want to check in if anybody had some, you know, outstanding question that arose in the middle of the night or, you know, burning away this morning as they got up. Yes?
That is the third dimension of virtue. There's three dimensions of virtue. Sorry.
Is this a test? I have so many dimensions and dimensions. I'm not exactly sure which dimension you're talking about. Has anybody got their notes? Okay. Oh, okay. I think I'm with you on this. Restraint, that one. Okay. Undertaking the skillful and the wholesome bodily, verbal, and mental acts of metta. That's the bodily, wholesome bodily skillful acts. And the third was the intention to bring benefit to others. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't quite say that, no, but I did say probably something. I think what you're probably alluding to is that the two different dimensions of the parami is that one is path and one is fruition. So when the paramis are consciously being cultivated and practiced and applied, this is really describing the path. It requires effort, it requires renewal of intention. And so it, you know, it's very kind of centralized within that place of practice. But they are called transcendent perfections at times. So this is really referring to their fruition, that with the deepening of the practice, with the deepening of their cultivation, there is a movement into that place of fruition where they're not coming from a place of effort or intention, but they have become much more naturalized. They're in your bones. In other words, there is no other choice. We might say there's no other choice. This is the shape of the mind. This is the shape of the heart, which is why they're really describing the fabric of an awakened mind. It's not as if they're, you know, cultivate energy. There is energy. Not as if I'll cultivate patience. Patience is the nature of the mind. Amen? So, but this is, you know, this is a path of development, but that there is a fruition of that development. And it basically that the intentionality place is gone, which means the effort place is also gone. They are naturalized.
Yeah. So naturalized, then, in the sense that it's the mind free of hindrances.
Free of hindrances and... And being very mindful that the hindrances, you know, that we tend to bump into every now and again, that those five hindrances are really the five manifestations of greed, hatred, delusion. Okay. So there's two things happening simultaneously here, that the deepening of the paramis is, and they're kind of expanding and development, is simultaneously the decreasing of the hindrances and greed, hatred, delusion. These two things are happening in coordination. They're not happening separately. But what we're really talking about in the paramis is you know, there's one approach to the path which is very much involved in, you know, kind of letting go of the hindrances, reducing the hindrances, reducing greed, hatred, delusion. But that might be the sort of central focus. The paramis, and that's actually only a partial focus, I must say. And I think we need to be careful of making that over-prioritizing or giving too much weight to how am I going to break through dullness, break through this, break this. Because if we really look at the teachings in the tradition, it is so much that this falls away in the light of this. So in the development of the paramis and development of the actual cultivation, the bhavana, which is the only word for meditative development in Pali, is bhavana, in that cultivation, this falls away. Because it's changing the shape of the mind and the heart, in which there is no place for greed, hatred, delusion, and all of the selfing that goes around that to really find a foothold. It's a shift, it is a shift in emphasis, and I think it's a very important shift in emphasis. Because I feel for so many people that their practice does too much have a little bit of a baffled flavor. You know, me against the hindrances, you know, da, 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 you know, we could make a movie, you know. There's all kinds of difficult implications that get attached to that around success and failure and progress and regression and selfing and all of that. So I think it is something to be very careful of, to be mindful of our kind of essential attitude to practice. You know, what is this in the service of? What are we cultivating? What are we bringing into being? And of course there are veils and distortions that come along, but not to be so diverted by those veils and distortions that becomes a sort of primary weight of our practice, is battling the veils and distortions. What does it mean in the midst of that actually to cultivate the paramis? Yeah.
Mine was kind of, it goes on from there, is I was thinking last night, well, okay, I'm going to take on the renunciation as your agitation. And then I thought, whoa, is that agitation? I mean, I immediately could feel how to have this, you know, heroic battle.
However, do bear in mind that what we started with yesterday in Virya, that its translation is heroism. So, heroism does not mean there have to be winners and losers. Heroism has much more to do with the unshakability of our commitment, the unwavering level of our intentionality. That is more the heroism. It's not about winning or losing, you know, about battles. It is really about, it has much more to do with that confidence of what we set our hearts upon. This is the intention I'm cultivating. And it's really wonderful to take just even one of the paramis as a practice for a period of time. You know, because as we mentioned yesterday, it will draw all of the other paramis in. It will draw the whole of the path in. So the heroism has much more to do with, and I'll go into that now, the unwavering level of commitment. And I think we all recognize how hard that is and just how easy it is to be swayed and dissuaded in life. You know, and this is, as the Buddha called it, Mara. You know, something better to do with our attention, or more interesting, or more exciting, or whatever. But we'll go into that a little bit more with the virya. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't get that. Who said?
Well, it's our nature is, our essential nature is awake.
I'm not sure of that. I'm not entirely sure that I would agree with that.
Well, there was the whole part about taking happiness as the foundation.
Yeah. Yeah. So cultivating happiness as the foundation for mindfulness.
So what you're saying is that you're not sure that our essential nature is awake. And I'm tying that into the unconscious competence.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I say I'm not sure about that, you know, sometimes I hear people say that, but I don't see anything to bear that out in the early texts. What I see in the early texts is the certainly the acknowledgement, for sure, that we are building the seeds of great compassion, of peace, of immense kindness and generosity, that the seeds of profound understanding lie within our consciousness. But they are seeds. So it's almost, in the early texts, it's almost recognizing that, you know, our consciousness, we live in our minds, our hearts live in a state of potentiality. Which I think, you know, bears out in our own experience moment to moment, that we see that our hearts and minds have this potential for tremendous hatred and tremendous generosity. Same happening within the same consciousness. And much of what really comes into being is tied into so many other factors, whether, you know, intention, commitment, knowing that sense of possibility, that's a big one, you know, confidence. What are we nurturing? What is really shaping our heart moment to moment? And of course, what is said, I mean, the Buddha put it so succinctly, you know, in the statement that what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. And that the shape of our mind most often becomes the shape of our world. And I think we see that, you know, in our own experience moment to moment. If we dwell on resentment, resentment becomes the shape of our mind. You know, if we dwell in anxiety, anxiety becomes the shape of our mind. And we do see the world as a threat, as a fearful place. So what is really, I think, really more emphasized in the teaching is that this is not a mystery. It's not a place of bewilderment. That really part of the seeds that live within our own consciousness is this capacity to bring to fruition that which really liberates. You know, that we're not just these sort of bystanders who, where things just happen to us, and that actually that bringing to fruition does actually mature into an unshakable wakefulness, an unshakable peace, an unshakable compassion. But that's actually not where we started. Where we started was very much sometimes a compassion that can be shaken. You know, a peace that can be shaken, a calmness that can be shaken. But actually it is that maturity that leads to the unshakability. So it's more the seeds and the potentiality, I think, that are being acknowledged. But that it's really, in a way, in our hands. Yes.
I'm realizing the importance of the questions we ask ourselves.
Yes.
And so much of meditation, I'm just trying to figure out what's going on.
Well, that's a good question. It is a good question. I don't know about better questions. But I think the whole point of listening to teaching is an encouragement to ask ourselves the questions that can make a difference. You know, and so there is probably a relationship between the questions that we're able to ask ourselves and the kind of intentions that we're able to set for ourselves. You know, if I think of just one or two examples of that, you know, but if I see that I'm sort of habitually sort of aversive or snappy, you know, I might ask myself, where does that arise from? And then I might make the intention, let me really have that intention in the forefront of my mind to actually really start to read the landscape of aversion and see what might be possible in that moment. So there may be a relationship between the questions and the intentions, and the intentions are flavoring very much our path. And I wouldn't at all underestimate this quality of intentionality in practice. I mean, I feel every time we sit down, we should ask ourselves a question, what is this time in the service of? You know, what is this time dedicated to? And I think this is particularly true of people with more experience in practice, because we all know how easy it is to be sort of established in the role of the meditator. You know, I've got the right clothes and, you know, the right cushion, and, you know, I just sort of plonk myself down and wrap my shawl around me and doze, or just kind of not necessarily have a sense of path. You know, not necessarily have a sense of path. And I think it's so important to keep in our mind, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, to come out of this limited field of my practice and what is the path that I'm walking on. And in that sense, I think it's really important, every sitting, every walking, what is this dedicated to? What is in the service of it? It doesn't have to have a right answer. You know, it doesn't have a right answer, but I think it's a reminding of ourselves that this actually is a path that is dedicated, that has a sense of direction. And then we try and figure out what's going on.
It must be something on this road. Anyway, so going back to what you touched on yesterday and some of the conversation just now, I can grasp and experientially relate to knowing the kind of self.
Yeah.
But, and a but, I guess this is a question, with all of these comments about and aspirations, and commitment and determination, I have some difficulty with my centralized, non-independent self.
Why?
Because I don't know then how is that, you know, kind of drawing upon all of this, you know, listening to and understanding and wanting to commit myself to. So where is that? I mean, what is
there's no what is doing it. It does itself. I mean, and being aware that no independent self-existence, please keep reminding yourself, this is not a nihilistic teaching. You know, I mean, I showed up here this morning. I'm pretty aware it's me talking, you know. This is good news, you know. I mean... You know, and I'm pretty sure that I have an intention in doing that, and I have an intention in actually bringing it together to do it. You know, and it was certainly me through all of that. That's not an issue. You know, that's just kind of making my life work. It's not an issue. It doesn't mean I have to have a belief system underneath that that says, you know, oh, you know, I'm doing this, you know, and oh, you know. It doesn't have to have any sort of belief system underneath. This is conventional, you know, getting up in the morning, doing what needs to be done, and knowing who's doing it. So that doesn't have to have any belief system of an independent self-existence. It's simply convention. It's simply convention. And it's also the loveliness of those conventions, you know, because your conventional self is quite, in some ways, quite unique to you. And isn't that lovely? You know, and the person beside you, their conventional them is quite unique to them with their own story and history and, you know, all of the rest of it that comes with it that brings aliveness and uniqueness and specificity to their life. And there's no way, we're not trying to homogenize here. We're not trying to somehow think that everybody should turn up as some kind of, you know, cloned non-self. It's fine, you know, we will always be that with our own unique joys and sorrows and loves and interests. It's not a problem. You know, if you look at the Buddha, he certainly had a personality. You know, there's no move, and it's really important to hold that, you know, because I so feel that there's a danger in people endeavoring to understand non-self, feeling that it's a kind of subduing factor. It's an insight, you know, it's really an insight, you know, because it's an insight into the emptiness of all of those formations of me, including my story and my passions and my intentions. They're empty too. You know? So then there's nothing to cling to.
But I'm clinging, and I guess commitment is pretty close to clinging to the path.
No.
Aspirations.
That would be the shadow side of commitment, would be clinging to the path. And we see that lots of time in the Dharma world, don't we? You know, my path, my hot wire to enlightenment, you know, my lineage, you know, my... We see that, the shadow side, lots of times in the Dharma world. But that's actually not the same as commitment. That's the near enemy of commitment, is using the path to create a new sense of identity and safety and self. But that's the shadow side. That's not necessary. And you know, the truth is that it's very rare in this life that our intentions are entirely unmixed. So many times we're living with a very clear, you know, heartfelt sense of intentionality. And there can be, here's this little near enemy just sitting alongside, you know, I'm a Vipassana meditator, or I'm a, you know, this is my lineage, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's sitting alongside, but that's not a problem. If we wage it and tie our attention with... intention was entirely undiluted, we would wait for a very long time. Okay? So what happens is not so much that our intention has to be undiluted and entirely free from clinging, but it depends when we begin what we hang our hat upon. Am I going to reinforce the clinging? So that's the ways we can do that. Or am I going to move towards the actual commitment level? Pardon?
I think we're going to get batteries.
Life is so simple sometimes.
I wonder what that would do for commitment.
Might be a sign of having talked too much when you wear out a set of batteries. How are we now? Technical moment. Just have a pause. Yeah, it's not the end of the world if this doesn't work, right? It's not the end of the world if this doesn't work.
Or we can work through
Yeah, think about that in, that's great. Think about that in so many ways, how many times our intentions can be mixed. You know, like we may feel very generous, you know, want to be very generous to someone, and we hope someone notices. Okay? So it's very often the case that intentions are mixed in that sense. It's not necessarily an issue. We need to acknowledge, it's helpful to acknowledge that. It's really helpful to know that. But then when we move then through the intention into action, we need to be quite mindful of what we are putting our weight behind. For example, I may go to, you know, I may want to be very generous towards Sims, but I'll wait until a break before I put that check in the donor basket, you know, because I want someone to notice, or I just go and do it. You know, so it's really about as we move into action, as we move into embodiment, what are we hanging our, putting our weight behind? I think this happens pretty much in every dimension of our emotional lives, our intentional lives. But it is fine. I think we should probably move on. So I want to continue with this parami of virya that does have these different dimensions of energy, of effort, of diligence, of commitment. But as I mentioned yesterday, which is most accurately translated as heroism, which, I think that's a very important word to consider, you know, because, again, it's a little bit, you know, like one of those words like noble or ennobling, where we might feel that it actually doesn't have anything to do with us. But it does have something to do with how this practice is brought to fruition. So in the paramis, this quality of virya is very much linked to compassion. It's linked very much to a wider sense of concern. Remembering how much these paramis are part not only of the awakened mind, but part of the fabric of compassion, which is knowing that we do not do this only for ourselves. That we practice for those we love, for those we don't know, for those that we struggle with. We are actually practicing to bring about the easing of all suffering and struggle and torment. It's very much taking a practice wider than just that field of my practice, my aspirations, my goals, what I want, to recognize that this has always been, certainly in Buddhist teaching, the motivation for this path. It is nothing new. It has always been the motivation for this path. If one goes to the early texts, it is repeated again and again to practice for the welfare of all beings, to practice for the ending of suffering wherever it exists. Now, this actual motivation, I feel has a lot to do with energy, with the amount of energy and the amount of virya that we actually have available to us. Because we see when, you know, there's no judgment in this at all, but we do see that when our practice is particularly permeated by personal goals, we might say, when we have just personal goals, you know, that I'd like to be more calm, or I'd like to be more happy, or, you know, I'd like to have a kinder life. There's nothing wrong with those motivations. But we do see that when our motivations are primarily about me, then those goals really are the forerunners, of course, to success and failure, gain and loss, feeling inspired in the times when our practice is going, by our standards, really well, and feeling very doubtful and uncertain in the times where our practice feels to be very dry or not going anywhere or not delivering what we'd like, or in the face of difficulty. Now, I think this is really important, because, you know, when our motivation is primarily about me, then of course our energy is going to falter very easily in the times when things feel flat or dry or uncertain. Now, what difference does it make if we feel that we actually practice for the welfare of all beings? And actually, you know, it doesn't matter a whit whether we feel like we're getting somewhere or not. Doesn't matter at all whether we're getting good or bad or difficult experiences in practice. Doesn't matter at all. What actually matters is that we're actually making a commitment, moment to moment, day to day, to actually clarifying or lessening the mountain of suffering in the world. That is in my life. I mean, I don't know if this makes any sense to you at all. But I think to have that wider sense of concern is a reflection in itself, isn't it? It doesn't necessarily come very easily, particularly in times when our own lives feel perhaps, you know, filled with crisis or difficulty. The very nature of that is to contract, isn't it? You know, to contract around, you know, myself, my concerns. And again, there's nothing wrong with that at all. But it's very easy to lose sight of this wider motivation of the whole of this path, which never had anything to do with self-improvement. Never had anything at all to do with just delivering, you know, a more improved mind for me. Now, energy becomes very fragile, I think, in the light of just simply, you know, we need to, as I mentioned yesterday, in a part of insight, is personal story. It's our personal story, our personal lives. But energy falters very easily, I think, if we lose sense of that wider motivation, because everybody's path has times when it's not going, doesn't feel to be going anywhere. Everybody's practice has times. But this is not about experience, this practice is not about experience. It really is much more about insight into experience. Now, I think there's something really helpful just to track in our own lives, and that is the link between interest, intention, and energy. Now, sometimes we're trying to make intentions, but if there is no foundation of genuine interest, those intentions won't sustain. We see this over and over again in our life. I mean, if we're, you know, if you're falling in love, nobody has to ask you to pay attention. If you're falling into hate, nobody has to ask you to pay attention either. You know, but really our attention, our mindfulness, will follow what we are interested in. Now, If we look at how we spend our days, what we give time to, what we give energy, what we give attention to, it becomes pretty clear to us what we're really interested in. So part of this path where it is so focused upon listening to the teaching, it is to really first foster this ground of interest, curiosity, investigation. Then intention is going to follow. And energy follows intention and interest. I mean, notice, you know, I mean, this is totally sort of a mundane example, but if I was like really totally fascinated with cars and I was going to buy a new car, you know, I would have so much energy for that. I would be up at 5 in the morning, you know. But, you know, am I up to do that, to actually sit and look at my own mind and heart? It's really not underestimating this level of interest and how we stimulate. It's why, you know, the constant reminders in our life are so important to keep that level of interest and curiosity alive. Because interest is something that is nourished. It's not just something that's in place and we never have to remember it. It's like intention is something that is set, you know, 100 times in a single day, sometimes maybe in a single hour, but based upon interest, because without interest, intention easily turns into this kind of should, this kind of forcing. You know, I should be doing this because I'm a practitioner. Actually, am I really interested in awakening? Am I really, deeply interested in that capacity, that possibility? Am I really interested in understanding? To have that interest alive, it's almost we need those reminders. And those reminders, you know, in many of our lives are sitting alongside this whole world of distractedness, isn't it? Our possibility of distractedness and forgetfulness. Forgetfulness. It is why, you know, that translation as I mentioned yesterday of mindfulness or sati as remembering. Remembering because it's so easy to forget. Remembering because it's so easy to be forgetful. I just want to kind of really stress, you know, how this whole development of this path is really arising from, you know, qualities of kindness and compassion. Not out of, you know, scolding and rebuking and shoulding. And it's how to keep that sense alive. Wise energy or wise virya, if we put it very simply, it's always directed towards the liberation from confusion and suffering and struggle. It's always directed towards liberation from greed, hatred, and delusion. Many of you will be familiar with the kind of sub-list of the wise efforts that the Buddha spoke about as being, you know, actual contemplations and actual applications in our life and in our practice. The first of those to prevent the arising of the unwholesome. The effort to do that. The second of those wise efforts to abandon the unskillful and the unwholesome that has already arisen. The third of those to arouse or to cultivate the wholesome that has not yet arisen. And the fourth of them, to deepen and to sustain the wholesome and skillful that is present. These are all part of the fabric of the actual practice of meditation, but also part of the fabric of how we actually approach our minds in our lives. They're the sort of guidelines of how we approach our minds and our hearts and our lives. So what you really get a sense of here, and I hope you get a sense of here, is when the Buddha talks about this path, he talks about it as a very dynamic, engaged process. Not busy, but an ongoing investigation, but something that is very dynamic and engaged. And sometimes, I mean, I must say, I get a little scared when I hear, you know, the kind of cliches more and more come out in our world about this practice of just be with what is. The Buddha never said that. He never ever said that. Instead, he describes this dynamic engagement with this ongoing processes of our minds and hearts in under the light of investigation, of seeing what eases suffering, what brings suffering into being, but something that is so creative and so actually dynamic that there's no element of just watching. There's no element of that if you look at the early texts in this path. So we're conscious, as we've talked about it, you know, over these days so far. We're talking about cultivating the skillful, cultivating that potentiality, those seeds of possibility within us, moment to moment, amidst our life, amidst everything that comes in our lives. Where is the kindness? Where is the compassion? Where is the generosity? Where is the mindfulness? Where is the calmness in this moment? To cultivate that, to know when those qualities are present, you know? Not to slide over them. Oh, what does peace feel like? What does generosity actually feel like in the heart and mind? What is the landscape of compassion? What is the landscape of kindness? To actually really know that, to really have that taste of the loveliness of the skillful. Remember when I said that yesterday that energy or virya arises from the finding joy in the wholesome and the skillful? Actually finding joy in it. And then we're looking at those seeds too, preventing the arising of the unskillful and the unwholesome. That's interesting, isn't it? How do we do that? Well, we learn to protect the mind with mindfulness. We learn to protect the minds in a way so that it's not so vulnerable to obsessions or to greed or to hatred. How do we protect the mind? With metta, with calmness, with serenity, with investigation. Sometimes we protect the mind not only inwardly but also outwardly. You know, if I have a tendency towards being an alcoholic, it's not a good idea to hang out in bars. You know, sometimes we protect the mind from the arising of the unskillful and abandon the unskillful that has already arisen. And you know, this is kind of where the Buddha does talk about some muscle in this practice. You know, let's not just watch this and hope that it goes away. Let's just actually not feed it. He uses this word abandon over and over again. Abandon the unskillful. That means put no fuel on that fire. Put no fuel on that fire with obsession, with thought, with holding, with clinging. Abandon the unskillful. It talks a lot of ways to abandon the unskillful. There's a whole set of discourses, number 19 to 23 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, which are primarily dedicated to working with the most stubborn, intractable, unskillful states of mind that we carry with us in our lives. And he goes through this long list of how to abandon the unskillful. Take your attention elsewhere. Cultivate what's missing. Investigate. Use metta. It goes through this long list, you know, press your tongue against the roof of your mouth, you know, resolve not to do this, you know, and if all else fails, ask for help. But, you know, it goes through this long list of, you know, just don't entertain it. Not because it's bad, not because it's wrong, but simply because you know that those patterns are going to lead you to fall into the same pits that you know too well, and there is not one more drop of insight to be squeezed out of falling in that hole. It's a habit. And it, you know, this is kind of one of the meditative neuroses, you know. I just need to go around this loop one more time because there's something I haven't learned here. I have learned everything I'm going to learn, you know. There's no more juice there. It's a habit. Abandon it. Just abandon it. Before we move on. Yeah.
Where did you say that list was? In
the middle length sayings, in the suttas that begin with the Honeyball Sutta, it's Sutta number 19 in the middle length saying. It goes through from 19, I think, to 21.
What's that
middle length? The middle length sayings. You'll find it on Access to Insight. Beginning with the Honeyball Sutta, but it's 19 to 21.
a role to allow things to arise and be able to see them and not say go away?
It is a question of discernment, and I don't think it's so much a question of allowing things to arise. Things arise, you know, emotions arise, you know, reactions arise, impulses arise, thoughts arise. Now, what we are moving away from is a feeling, you know, a reaction to habit of resistance and aversion and blame and judgment, to actually seeing. So the seeing is, as you say, absolutely the first step. The discernment is absolutely the first step that is followed by wise action or wise effort. And the wise effort might be to investigate, it might be simply to be, explore what is there. It might be to abandon, but discernment certainly is, as you say, the first step. Yeah. So I want to just look a little bit at one of the, as I've mentioned, if you ever want to look at some of the paramis, you know, in more detail. And Shanti Deva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life is very important. But there is a text that I am fond of. I must say, not all teachers are fond of. But it's by Patro Rinpoche, and it's called In the Words of My Perfect Teacher, where there has a particularly good section, I think it's a great section, on the paramis. But in this, Patro Rinpoche talks about three kinds of virya, three kinds of energy that I think are useful reflections. Now, in this, remembering that virya, again, this is one of these words that, you know, in English translation is sometimes inadequate because it speaks about energy, effort, commitment, but also diligence. Staying power. This is something really that is part of virya, our capacity to persevere. So Patro Rinpoche talks about three kinds of virya: armor-like virya, virya in action, and insatiable virya. When he is speaking about armor-like virya, this is, we could substitute perseverance for this, this unwavering perseverance. And he uses this metaphor, which I think is really important. He says, when we hear the stories of the lives of the great teachers and bodhisattvas, the deeds they did and the trials they went through, do not be discouraged. Never think they were only capable of achieving what they did because they were great Buddhas and teachers, and that you could never do the same. Remember that it was simply by acting in this way that they became so accomplished. Simply by acting in this way, not pretending, but endeavoring to embody what was really valuable over and over again in the face of all the distractions, all of the calls of habit, all of the diversions. You might think, what would a Buddha do here? That kind of unwavering staying power. And he goes on to this. Can I read you a little bit from his? He says, we have all of the freedoms of a human being. Now we have the opportunity to practice the Dharma. We should vow from the bottom of our hearts to do so, be prepared to undertake austerities. Things are difficult at times. Take on burdens and risk life and limb. People in countless countries in Asia do exactly that right now. They actually risk life and limb to practice the Dharma. It is not something just of past ages. This is what is meant by armor-like diligence or perseverance. He goes on to say, do not spend your whole life telling yourself you will practice one day, letting each day slip by. Death comes closer with every second. If you put off till tomorrow what could be done today, how you will regret it on your deathbed. Devote yourself now, otherwise you will never find the time. Worldly activities, worldly distractions are just endless, like ripples on the water. They will only stop when you decide to end them. It goes on. There's a little bit more to say on the subject. Preoccupations never end until the moment we die. They end when we put them down. Such is their nature. Let all your actions be spurred by your understanding of impermanence. This is what is called diligence in action. So the first part was armor-like diligence. Second was diligence in action, about what we actually do. Remember we talked about this yesterday, that this is a lot of this path is about what we do, not what we think, not what we feel, not what we admire, but actually what we do. And then it goes on to talk about insatiable diligence. Do not feel satisfied just at having done a little retreat or one or two good works. Vow to practice for as long as you live and determine to keep your efforts going with all the power of a great river until you are liberated. Try to make greater and greater efforts each day, never allowing body, speech, or mind to slip into idleness or to separate from the teachings for much, so much as an instant. To practice with greater tenacity, the closer one gets to death, is the mark of a Dharma practitioner who has not been caught by the frost. Thinking we do not need to practice proves one needs to more than ever. He ends with the words, always moderate your eating, arrive at a balanced amount of sleep. Make your efforts steady and constant. Make your mind like a good bowstring, neither too loose nor too tight. It will get you nowhere to practice radically only when you have time. I'm glad he said that, because I would know. I would find... This is someone 1,500 years ago saying this, or 1,000 years ago, speaking about exactly the same challenges that we face in our own paths and our own lives. That it's not, you know, it's easy. This was not just a contemporary issue. How to find that motivation, how to find that undissuadedness, that unswerving perseverance, how to find the inspiration that springs from. And that's most important, the inspiration that springs from. You know, it's no value to, I think, or no, it's not true, it's less value to turn up and practice every day because I'm ticking the boxes, you know. But where is the inspiration to practice and to, with all the power of a great river until we are liberated? In that kind of heroism in Virya.
So, I've been practicing for a long time. And, last year, there has been so much dissolution in my life. It's been unbelievable. My parents are dying, and my children left for college. My partner and I split up. We sold our home, and I came up to the Northwest, and my goddaughter was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She's only 17. She has it all over her body.
I'm taking care of my sister and her. And then a friend of ours just committed suicide, and it just feels like it's just pouring on me, you know?
Yes.
And I was thinking about my practice, and I was thinking that for a long time, one of my awarenesses in my practice has been about dissolution. And about when everything dissolves, you know, in practice, what's left, you know? And now it's like my life is doing that. It's like, and one of the questions that comes up for me around effort with it is, like, a friend of mine in my sangha in Boulder said, before I left, he said, you take care of people so much. And he said, do you really need to take care of people as much as you do? Is it for you? Is it for them? And it was a really big contemplation for me. It was like, and I'm a mother, you know, like when you're a mother, you learn to take care of people, you know. But it's almost like sometimes I feel like my life is by default becoming the life of somebody who loses everything and is like depending on people. Like I'm staying with people in it right now so that I can take care of my sister, and they're taking care of me so that I can take care of her. And it's like, oh my God, it's like I'm totally like groundless now, you know, like I don't have any way in which I have my own identity in the world anymore in that way.
Yeah.
So that question about effort, like one of the things about being an American in particular, and I've traveled quite a bit in my life, so I have some perspective about this culture, is that there's so much emphasis on securing oneself.
Yeah.
There's such a huge emphasis on having your home, having your car, having your bank account, having your retirement fund, and, you know, having a job, and then when it all kind of falls apart on you, you know, it's like, oh my God, I have no status in this country anymore, you know, like, I don't have any of those things, and it's not my concentration in my life right now, and so it's like that question of the monastic path of Buddhism, you know, and renunciation, actually, it can create doubt, you know. There's kind of like, whoa, this path is taking it's shredding my life.
Yeah. Well, it's not just the path that is shredding your life right now, is it? It's all the people and the circumstances and the changes and the crises and the dissolutions that are shredding your life, which is incredibly painful at times. No one should ever pretend that that loss is somehow going to be moderated by being on a path. In many ways, you know, I think that's a kind of a misunderstanding in this path, you know, that if you're a really good practitioner, you're not going to grieve, you're not going to feel the painfulness of loss. You do grieve and you do feel the painfulness of loss. These are very human emotions, and in many ways you might even feel them more deeply because you're undistracted. And so what you describe, I think there is also one or two other people in this room who are actually in that state where everything falls apart. Everything falls apart. And particularly, as you say so rightly, you know, this is a culture, you know, that relies upon being somebody. And being somebody, you become somebody by having and becoming and owning and possessing, you know, and having this. And that is why this is so countercultural. And so hard, I think, in this culture, you know, to actually see the liberation in being no one, which is not disappearing, it's not nihilistic, it's not about, you know, not acting, not doing anything in the world, but about not clinging to anything. And when everything is lost, you know, that groundlessness, this is nothing to cling to here. But what I would say, when you're in those times of your life when everything falls apart, and I think probably all of us experience that us will experience one of those moments in our life. It's really important to get really simple. For sure, all of the questions come in, what comes next, particularly questions come in. And, I really feel in those times when, there is kind of critical mass in life, critical mass asks for exactly the same degree of simplicity in what actually we pay attention to. And we get up in the morning, we say, what do I really need to pay attend to today? What do I really need to attend to today? And, these questions of do we care too much? We never care too much. We can care unwisely at times, but we never care too much. But I think there's this simplicity when life falls apart, you have to find some refuge. I mean, groundlessness is actually the reality we've always lived with. We just don't want to acknowledge it. But that doesn't deny the capacity to find refuge, which is talked about all the time in this path. But sometimes your refuge in those moments is actually in not knowing. And, I certainly have found, a couple of times in my life when I've been in critical mass situations, I actually use that as a practice, have used that as a practice. I take refuge in not knowing. What does it mean to stand still in that space? Just to be still in that space, rather than grappling for answers, solutions, what's needed, what comes next. So I take refuge in not knowing. What does it mean just to really stand still in that space that feels so uncertain? There's something quite remarkable in that if you can do it. But it's also a practice. Because in a way you don't know. I mean, things dissolve. They will reconstruct in some way that you don't know at this point. But for sure, they will. But how they reconstruct maybe have something to do with the kind of stillness. Because you know how agitated you can be in these moments. You could get so agitated with leaning forward into the next moment. I need to reconstruct something. I need to become someone. I need to find, something to do. You can become so agitated in those moments. Or you can really, really hold on to stillness by your fingernails. And use that practice if I take refuge in not knowing. In moments when you feel any movement towards the agitation, because there's a remarkable wisdom in actually acknowledging the groundlessness that has always been part of our lives and how easily things can just unravel.
Yeah, and it feels like for me, I'm not actually reaching into wanting to construct things because I don't, and I actually have a lot on my plate with my niece.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm floundering, going,
what
am I supposed to do?
It's
like,
here's
this, what. Be right here, right now. And it feels like what you talked about is Buddhism not being a practice but a path. I'm really experiencing that in my life now because I've practiced a lot.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, this is now my path.
Yep.
It's not just something I do when I'm sitting.
Yeah.
It's everywhere now.
Yeah.
It's all over the place and just learning how to be skillful in it being everywhere.
Yep. Yeah. And I was very sensitive to that last year when I was kind of called to nurse my father after triple heart bypass, and they just kind of spit him out of the hospital after a week, and he was so ill. And I thought, and I was just the only one there. I thought, I practiced my whole life for this. It was really that sense. I practiced my whole life for this. To know how to be here. To be the one who doesn't flail and flounder and panic and who can actually hold this space in some way that's helpful. And it's just that sense, okay, well, this is going to, yeah, I practice my whole life for this. And maybe you practice your whole life for this. And that's where the path is.
Sambhega. I thought of that in relationship to her situation.
Yeah. The sort of spiritual urgency, I think it's often those moments when we are somehow startled into wakefulness. You know, and we all have moments in our lives when we're startled into wakefulness, often by the difficult, sometimes actually by the lovely. You know, you can be startled into wakefulness by something so that touches you so deeply, that is so lovely, often so simple. But we are at times also startled into wakefulness by dissolution, when things just fall away and we really realize how out of control, we never were in control, we never could create certainty, we never could grasp the ungraspable. And we're left without wakefulness. And, you know, those moments of wakefulness can go a lot of different ways depending on whether we've practiced our whole life for this. You know, they can sink into despair and agitation, depression, anxiety, or we really see these other moments where, you know, those seeds of compassion, of generosity can really, you know, that unhesitating wish. It can be the unhesitating wish to reach out to help another. It can also be that spiritual urgency, like, I have no time to waste here. It's a little bit like Padre Rinpoche says, you know, that to practice only the closer we get to death is not to have been bitten by the frost. Well, you know, we get bitten by the frost a lot in our lives. And then that's the ongoing reminders, yes, wake up.